From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The fury following the U.S. cruise missile attacks today on Democracy Now! The Clinton administration claims it targeted suspected terrorist sites, but there were many civilian casualties. What was the real motivation for the unilateral assault? And why does information about the suspects in the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania keep changing? Plus, a look at poverty in the United States. The richest 1% of Americans now hold nearly half of the nation's wealth. What does that mean for the rest of us? All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir said on Monday his country reserved the right to hit back at the United States for destroying a Khartoum pharmaceutical plant, but would act within the law. Bashir again rejected U.S. charges that the $32 million plant, reduced to rubble by last Thursday's missile attack, was making chemical weapons. If it had been, he said, the strike would have caused a disaster for civilians. He blamed the attack on President Bill Clinton personally, not the American people. Bashir reiterated Sudan's denials of U.S. charges that the Shifa pharmaceuticals plant produced a nerve gas component or had any connection with Saudi-born dissident Osama bin Laden. Sudan has asked the UN Security Council to send a fact-finding mission to inspect the factory, which the government says is owned by Sudanese businessmen Salah Idris and Ahmed Idris. Bashir said the United States had relied on what he called false information from treacherous Sudanese opposition groups. The U.S. carried out Thursday's strikes against what it called terrorist-related targets in Sudan and Afghanistan after this month's bombings of U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, in which more than 260 people were killed. Washington accuses bin Laden, who moved to Afghanistan from Sudan in 1996, of playing a key role in the bombing. The White House says Boris Yeltsin's cabinet's shakeup hasn't shaken up plans for his summit with President Clinton. The president heads for Moscow a week from today, and though U.S. officials will continue to monitor developments, spokesman P.J. Crawley says Yeltsin's firing of his entire cabinet yesterday is no reason to put off the summit. In the midst of a deepening financial crisis, the Russian president sacked Prime Minister Sergei Kiryenko and brought back Viktor Chernomyrdin, who was fired 5 months ago. Spokesman Crowley says from the White House point of view, the most important thing is not personalities but policies and implementing reforms needed to restore investor confidence. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi ended a 13-day roadside protest against military government restrictions on her movements on Monday. A short time earlier, about 120 students staged a sit-down protest against the government, witnesses say. That protest in the road close to Suu Kyi's compound near Rangoon University was broken up by riot police after about an hour. Diplomats said the protest was the first of its kind since December 1996, when the authorities closed the country's universities after a series of student protests. The 1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner and three supporters had been stuck in a minivan outside the capital since August 12, having been denied permission to travel west and in turn refusing government demands that she return home. Diplomats said the protesters chanted slogans calling for the downfall of the military government and gave out leaflets supporting the NLD and its vow to call a parliament. Rangoon University was a hotbed of anti-government protest in 1988 when the military crushed a student-led uprising for democracy. Diplomats said the protesters this week were wearing red headbands like those that became popular during that 10-year-old uprising. Analysts are saying that if Indonesia's military believes it can appease public anger over mounting evidence of past atrocities by casting out its most hated figure, it's mistaken. Armed Forces Chief General Wiranto announced earlier in the day that Lieutenant General Prabowo Subianto, son-in-law of the former President Suharto, had been sacked after a military investigation found him directly responsible for the abduction and torture of political activists. But as evidence continues to emerge of army involvement in torture, rape, and mass killings, the dismissal of Prabowo will not be enough to restore Indonesia's shaken confidence in its military, say the analysts. A human human rights team investigating reports of army atrocities during a 9-year crackdown against a separatist insurgency unearthed scores of bones at the weekend at sites believed to be mass graves for hundreds of army victims. Wiranto also admitted last week that troops were involved, as he put it, in the riots that ravaged Jakarta in mid-May, in which almost 1,200 people died and more than 150 ethnic Chinese women were raped. Thousands of striking communications workers headed back to picket lines in 13 western states today, while Connecticut phone customers braced for delays as a strike there entered its first business day. We're going to have more news on the workers on the CWA strike in tomorrow's Democracy Now! That's what you're listening to, Democracy Now! From Pacifica Radio. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders. This is Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders. Russian President Boris Yeltsin yesterday dismissed his prime minister and reinstalled Viktor Chernomyrdin not even 5 months after dismissing the older statesman personally and politically, and installing the young Kiryenko with great fanfare. Some are saying the apparent chaos at the top reflects the final collapse of the Russian autocracy, beyond even the saving of the IMF. Others are saying Chernomyrdin is a solid choice, what the New York Times called the consensus figure, at least for Russia's elite. To help us get a better grasp on what's really going on in Russia, we've got with us on the line Boris Kagolitsky, who is a political scientist at the Institute of Comparative and Labor Studies. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Boris.
Hello.
So tell us, first of all, I understand that Boris Yeltsin is on television today reassuring Russians that everything is just fine and that the future looks bright and brighter than it did 2 days ago.
Well, of course they say that every time. People don't believe that, as you can imagine. The problem is elsewhere, of course. People don't know what is ahead. Because now the reappearing of Chernomyrdin, though it's a sort of personal triumph for Chernomyrdin, it's a tremendous humiliation for Yeltsin. That's visible, that he's becoming really weak. And second thing is that though Chernomyrdin is reappearing as a sort of last moment miracle, I'm not sure that he's going to do anything to save the situation because he doesn't have the magic to solve the situation, which he also helped to create.
Tell us a little bit more about what you believe is happening with Boris Yeltsin. I mean, just to recap, back on August 14th, I think it was, Yeltsin vowed there would be no devaluation, gave his backing to Kiryenko, said he wouldn't cut short his holiday, and the market sort of stabilized a little bit after a plunge. And then just 3 days later, the government and central bank announced a package of drastic measures, exactly those that Yeltsin had just said were not going to happen, causing more chaos, of course, on the markets. There seems to be a kind of to-ing and fro-ing here, culminating with, on August 21st, an emergency session in the parliament calling for Yeltsin to resign. Tell us a little bit about how you're reading all of this.
Well, I think it's really very Orwellian. If you have read 1984 of George Orwell, I mean, you understand a lot about that because, for example, when Yeltsin said that devaluation wouldn't happen, for everybody on the street, it became absolutely clear that devaluation was going to happen very soon. And people also, I think, started getting their money away from the banks and so on. So in a certain sense, his statements, instead of discouraging the collapse, they kind of encouraged people to behave in such a way that collapse became even more spectacular, though I think it was coming anyway. For example, 2 days before Yeltsin's speech, the black market for hard currency reemerged, and people already gave something like 7,000 old rubles for $1 instead of 6.20, which was the official rate. And after Yeltsin's speech, the black market rate went up. People just don't trust the authorities. And as long as the authorities themselves are concerned, I think it's also sort of self-poisoning because the only people who still believe their propaganda are themselves. And they're discovering that in a very painful way nowadays. But that's only part of the story, because the real story behind that is that the whole system is unfunctional. And it's very funny, for example, to listen now when American President Clinton says that while personalities do not matter, what matters is the continuation of reforms to overcome the crisis, because this crisis is exactly the product of the so-called reforms. So if you want to overcome the crisis, you have to change the policies. If you want to overcome the crisis and at the same time to continue the policies which led you to this terrible crisis, I don't know how are you able to get out of the crisis. I mean, we will simply not get out of the crisis.
What about the fate of the IMF and its policies in Russia?
I think, first of all, it's also a tremendous simulation for IMF as well as for the Russian government, what's going on in Russia. Because, first of all, IMF sponsored the policies of the Russian government, of Yeltsin regime anyway. Every major step of the Russian government since 1991 already was always coordinated with the IMF, was discussed with the IMF, and was approved by IMF. So in that sense, they're totally responsible for all this mess. That's one thing. And that is what everybody knows, even people on the streets. Then, second is that while they brought it into this mess, they gave help to the Russian government, but actually it's not help, because we will have to pay for that. The government borrowed money. The government didn't get that money as a sort of grant. The money was not granted, it was lended. So now we owe another $2 billion, and there is more money to come for which we have the obligations to pay. And that was shown to the public, including the public in the West, as a sufficient sum of money to save the ruble, to save the financial system of Russia. And nevertheless, it collapsed already after this money being transferred to the Russian government, which means that IMF has no magic way of saving the regime and the system, which is collapsing anyway.
Boris Kagaliski, we hope to catch up with you again very soon. There are demonstrations planned in Russia. They talk about October. Others are saying it must be much sooner. We'll be back with you, I hope, soon to discuss developments. Thank you very much. Boris Kagaliski is a political scientist at the Institute of Comparative and Labour Studies. You're listening to Democracy Now! From Russia to Afghanistan and Sudan, but first Pakistan. An unexploded U.S. missile reportedly has been found in western Pakistan, but Pakistani officials are not commenting today after a similar report last week was later denied. Local officials said the missile was found in a remote area Sunday and handed over to the military the same day, 4 days after U.S. missile struck an alleged training camp in neighboring Afghanistan. They said the missile fell in Karan, 380 miles south of the U.S. target in Afghanistan. Pakistan, meanwhile, has protested the presumed violation of its airspace in the U.S. attack and said that a missile mistakenly fallen in Pakistan, which was mentioned earlier, killed several people. The government fired its intelligence officer after that for passing on what is now said to be a false report to the prime minister. So what really is going on here? On Friday's Democracy Now!, we heard about the bomb attack. We heard reports from Pakistan. Just hours later, the reversal of the Pakistani official position. And today, another bomb found in western Pakistan. We have with us on the line one guest, Hussein Ibish, who is the host of Voices of the Third World on Community Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts, and a regular commentator on Middle Eastern and other affairs. Also with us, joining us in our studio in Washington, D.C., is Jockey Jehu with the Kenya Action Network. Let's start with you, Professor Ibish. What is going on the Pakistani front? Do you believe the government reversal from Friday, that after having announced five people were killed by a U.S. missile, that was all then taken back?
Well, what I think is going on here is that what you're talking about is a border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan, where, in fact, the lines of demarcation are particularly unclear, and they're more unclear now that the Taliban are in control of most of Afghanistan than they even were before that. The Taliban and Pakistan are very closely linked, and, in fact, some would even say that the Taliban, the genesis of the Taliban, lies with the ISI of Pakistan, the Pakistani Intelligence Service. In any event, they're certainly very closely linked. And it's pretty clear that some of the so-called training camps that the United States hit, if they were training anyone, then they were being run by groups like Harkat al-Ansar and Jamiat Mujahideen, which, as the best understanding of everyone, is that they essentially train fighters to go and pursue the guerrilla war in Indian-administered Kashmir, which would not seem to advance United States' interests in attacking Osama bin Laden. However, it gives you an understanding of why there would be confusion and reticence on the part of the Pakistani government to discuss what they've been up to in this border region, especially with regards to covert activities in India.
Well, you mentioned the border conflict in Kashmir, and one thing that struck us over the weekend was just how close we may have come on Thursday to a nuclear conflagration. Presumably, if the Pakistanis had not had suspected that the missiles coming through their airspace were Indian, we could have seen quite a crisis there. What have you learned about that since Friday morning?
Well, personally, not much about that. I mean, I think it's sort of an obvious danger to send missiles across a tense airspace like that without first consulting with the Pakistanis. They insist that they were not consulted by the United States, and they're very upset about the presumptive use of their airspace, and it seems almost impossible that their airspace wasn't used. And I think even more suggestive is all the information which has been pouring out, the incredibly good evidence that the attack in Sudan was directed deliberately against a civilian target, which was known not to be any sort of a military production facility. The Observer, in yesterday's edition, the London-based newspaper, stated very clearly, based on very reliable sources apparently, that United States forces flew reconnaissance missions to find traces of gas and did not do so, and that the United States had concluded beforehand that this really, in fact, was not a chemical weapons factory, but for symbolic and political reasons decided to go ahead with it anyway and launched this attack.
Hussein Ibish, we're going to come right back to you, but as you've mentioned the Sudanese situation, we're going to travel to Africa, as it were, to discuss that particular part of this story with our other guest in the studio in Washington, Jockey Jehu. Sure enough, as Professor Ibish has just mentioned, the British Observer, but also today's Wall Street Journal, says that the owner of the Sudanese factory destroyed by U.S. missiles in Saudi Arabia, in Sudan, was a Saudi Arabian with no known ties to Islamic extremists, and in fact had never met Osama bin Laden. And the Sudanese offer of the remains of the site to UN investigators could pose quite a threat, in fact, to the U.S. What are you making of this, Jockey, from the African perspective? This was all, at least in part, these bombings done in the name of reprisals, taking back reprisal against those who bombed the embassy, the U.S. embassy, and killed so many Kenyans. Jockey and Jehu.
I think it's yet another tragedy being visited on African people. I talked to friends who are Sudanese on the day of the bombing, and they expressed feelings sort of how many of us Kenyans and Tanzanians felt when we started hearing the stories and seeing the reports about the bombing in Tanzania and Dar es Salaam, worrying about our friends, worrying about our families, and wondering, you know, what the hell was going on, because it is very scary to be getting reports like that, and the information was not very clear. So it's again a fight with the U.S. or between the U.S. and someone else that is being fought on in an African country and victimizing Africans. This is a fight between the U.S. and the terrorists, or a fight between the U.S. and someone else, but it is being fought in Africa, and it is a tragedy that is being visited on innocent people. This is not to say that we want to see this fighting going on in the U.S., but it is very, very frightening, even as you listen and see on the news what is happening in the U.S., even right here in Washington, in preparation for this supposedly coming soon near someone terrorist attack.
Jokey and Jehu, we're going to come right back to you. First, we're going to take a 60-second break for stations to identify themselves. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Joaquin Jehu is with us in our Washington Bureau from the Kenyan Action Network. Following up on where we just were 60 seconds back, Jockey, I think it wasn't so long ago that we talked to you, actually Pacifica Network News talked to you about the reaction in Nairobi to the embassy bombing and the U.S. handling of the bombing, and you talked about uprising resentment and anger against the United States. The scenes from Sudan this weekend are chilling to those who hope someday to have smoother relations internationally and the ability to travel internationally and see, you know, travel safely as an American in other parts of the world. What do you understand is brewing there in way of a response to this bombing of the pharmaceutical factory?
You know, I think that one of the dangers and one of the problems is the way that the U.S. government carries out its policy, and in so doing really endangers us all. You know, if you think about people who want to travel, who want to have good relationships with other people around the world, it becomes very, very difficult because U.S. government action or inaction in some cases is seen as being the will of the American people. And we know that that is not true. And because, for instance, how many people really care that the U.S. has troops in Saudi Arabia, and how many people really want to see their lives disrupted and to see their lives endangered in the U.S. and around the world because of U.S. unilateral action, as happened last Thursday. So it is very, very understandable that people in Sudan, people in Kenya, people around the world resent the way in which the U.S. government sometimes acts. And it calls into question about what is going on and why the U.S. insists on alienating and putting American people at risk around the world, because the people who are making the policies are the best protected people, as it were. It's the rest of us who really do not have the protection that that they get.
With us on the line from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Hussein Ibish. Professor Ibish, coming back to international law, one can only imagine what type of commentary we would have seen over the weekend, not to say legal action, had it, in fact, for example, been the Kenyan government that had decided to bomb Sudan in reprisal for the attack in their capital. And yet this weekend's talk about the missile attacks last Thursday was fairly vague as when it came to international law. What do you understand to be the issues at stake here legally?
Well, I mean, I think the United States is trying to invoke Article 51 of the UN Charter, which allows for self-defense. But self-defense has always been understood to be limited to countering a specific imminent threat. and not some vague suspicion, particularly in the case of the Sudan bombing, which seems to be entirely unrelated to any specific imminent action, and in fact it seems to have been fabricated excuse in terms of chemical weapons. But I think more importantly is the way it plays out politically rather than legally, because although legal arguments are made, we live in a world in which there isn't any global legal order and to speak of. It's simply deployed by the powerful against the weak. What's more interesting, I think, is that this sort of display by the United States, which is being trumpeted and received as a show of strength, is actually, I think, quite a major demonstration of weakness. It's one thing for a small, shadowy, even if a well-financed guerrilla group to resort to blowing up symbolic locations of a perceived adversary like embassies. And it's quite another thing when we witness the world superpower with all of its economic and diplomatic and juridical and military resources responding by immediately mimicking the tactics of marginal groups that are accused of bombing embassies. And what it suggests to me is a total inability on the part of the United States to come to terms with the broader issues of cause and effect that provide the context for these actions. And it seems designed to provoke an endless cycle of tit-for-tat attacks on symbolically significant but militarily insignificant targets like embassies and small base camps and candy and pharmaceutical factories, such as we've seen.
While we're talking about the political ramifications and the political context, it's to bring the situation back home or bring the impact of the story back home, today's Wall Street Journal carries an op-ed piece by so-called terrorist expert Stephen Emerson, a man who's been wrong so many times he continues to be quoted as an expert, how to really fight terrorism he uses as a pretext to call for stricter U.S. Justice Department investigation of what he describes as terrorist-supporting organizations in this country. How do you see that kind of call playing out in a current climate in which there are greater, there's greater rights and greater laws at the disposal of the Justice Department and the INS than ever for extraditing people and trying them for their political solidarity work here on the...
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's likely, the implication of your question is absolutely sound. It's likely that the outcome of this domestically is going to be greater repression. And I think it's going to continue to focus on immigrants, which is the focus of the latest McCarthyite provisions of the 1996 Anti-Terrorism Act, which was passed in the aftermath of the crash of TWA-800, which was now, it seems clear, either due to some sort of a freak technical accident or perhaps an errant United States Navy missile. It's not clear, but clearly not a terrorist incident. But I think, it's going to continue to focus on immigrants, mostly Arabs, mostly Muslims, mostly males, and certainly all the individuals who've been detained without charge and held indefinitely without charge so far have been Arab Muslim males, and I think we'll see that continuing. And I think this is, what it participates in is a generalized demonization of Arabs, Muslims, and Islam. Now, the president went out of his way to say that this was not an attack on Islam, and many journalists and other officials and newspaper columnists, etc., have run to sort of agree that this is in no way an attack on Islam or anything of the kind. But frankly, I think he doth protest too much. The American denial of this, in fact, only serves to reinforce the inevitable impression that attacks like these are attacks on Islam. After all, why would one feel the need to specifically deny such a relationship if it weren't a reasonable conclusion that people are bound to reach and is going to be widespread? And in fact, attacks on pharmaceutical factories in Sudan and training camps for guerrillas who fight in Kashmir, based in Afghanistan, only make sense in the context of current recurring themes of a green menace, generalized Islamic threat. And these themes would be things like, Islamist Arab radicals around the world, region-wide terrorist networks that cut across ideological boundaries, chemical, biological, and nuclear terrorism, which also invokes the specter of Saddam Hussein and Iraq. And what these themes do is draw together all Middle Easterners and Muslims and Arabs who are not under direct or indirect American political control and who may oppose U.S. policies in the Middle East into one sort of indifferentiated terrorist mass. And so any target in the Arab world, like a Sudanese medicine factory, becomes a legitimate focus of retaliation, vengeance, and aggression. And in fact, these politically counterproductive, destabilizing, and to be honest with you, militarily meaningless attacks like the ones we just saw by the United States only make sense in terms of what I have to call a hysterical discourse that ends up branding all Arabs and Muslims as terrorists. And so these attacks function precisely in that sense as attacks on Arabs and Islam in general, and denials only confirm this view, I think.
Hussein Ibish is with us from Amherst, Massachusetts. He's the host of Voices of the Third World on community radio there, and a journalist and frequent commentator on Pacifica Radio. We've also been joined by Joaquin Jehu, who is with the Kenyan Action Network in Washington, D.C. I'd like to thank you both very much for being with us here on Democracy Now! Well, we're talking about the political implications of the attack last week. On Afghanistan and Sudan. One of the underlying themes that we've been trying to follow here on Pacifica Radio is just what this indicates in the way of priority use of resources. Many commentators have talked about how ironic it is that on the anniversary of the signing of the so-called Personal Responsibility Act, the welfare reform law, so-called, at a time when we've been told constantly that federal coffers couldn't support the sustaining of low-income families, we nonetheless have seen this use of financial resources to carry out a military assault. That's been a kind of underlying theme. Another, of course, has been the effect of developments in Africa and Asia and Russia on the financial markets. Maybe it was the Asian financial crisis that caused the Dow Jones Index to seesaw by hundreds of points in the last 2 weeks, or slower corporate earnings, or news about President Clinton's predicament, or maybe it was something else. Maybe the foreign affairs that we're looking at are clouding something else that perhaps is at the basis of our current economic situation, which might be, according to a growing number of economists, the fact that there is an increasing gap between rich and poor. While the richest among us consolidate wealth, the middle class is slipping and the poor are worse off than ever. Income disparity between rich and poor Americans is now more extreme than at any time since 1929. And maybe, just maybe, that sort of fundamental factor describing current U.S. and global economics, that may be at the heart of the economic crisis that we keep seeing in the stock exchange. Less than a month after the Dow hit its all-time high on July 17th, new numbers on inequality reiterated the growing polarization. On August 10th, the Census Bureau reported one-third of Americans, especially people of color, women, and children, fell below the poverty line during 1993 and 95. On August 5th, new statistics showed personal bankruptcy at an all-time high. Consumer debt is also at an all-time high. August 2nd, the Commerce Department released numbers showing that in 1997, personal savings were down to 2.1%, lower than at any time since the Great Depression. What effect are these factors having on our economics, even as we tend to look abroad for explanations of our financial ups and downs? We have with us on the line and in our studios in Washington several guests who are going to help us try to make some sense of all this. The first is Sarah Anderson, who is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. She's joining us in our studio there. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sarah.
Thank you, Laura.
And maybe this is sort of simplistic, the picture that I'm putting out here, but it is true that I think, by way of explaining our financial highs and lows, we're often asked to look abroad. Your work and the work of others looking at the current statistics that have been coming out over the last few weeks describing the situation here would lead us to look closer to home for an explanation. Can you carry that a little further for our audience?
Well, there are so many things going on in the world that might be affecting the stock market these days. I don't know if I would like to argue that it's necessarily inequality here, but what I will say is that there are so many reasons why we should all be concerned about rising inequality here, and there are solid economic arguments. And I like to point out that it's not just me. In fact, some of the most celebrated capitalists from American history spoke out against rising inequality, people like J.P. Morgan, the banker. For him, it was clearly just a bottom line issue. He felt that, in fact, that the top guy at a company shouldn't be making more than 20 times what the bottom guy was making, because quite simply it would hurt worker morale so much that it would affect productivity. So for him, it was a bottom line issue. Also, Henry Ford spoke out against inequality. For him, it was focusing on the need for a strong consumer base, the idea that we need to have people who can afford to buy the products that his companies were producing. And so there are solid economic arguments for why we should be concerned about this issue. There was also a fascinating piece that came out in the Washington Post last week that looked at the impact of inequality on health. They compared countries that have low levels of inequality with those that have high levels of inequality and found out that, quite simply, people live longer when there are lower levels of inequality. So there's another health and economic reason for trying to come up with ways to turn this trend around.
For those who follow the markets, and we need to be reminded at all times that it's still a minority of people in the U.S. that trade with any tremendous regularity or frequency in the stock market in the U.S., for those that trade in the markets, how does the disparity between rich and poor affect the ups and downs of the Dow Jones, for example?
I'm not sure if I can say that because there are so many psychological factors here. But as you pointed out earlier, this is affecting the core of our economy. I think that we also need to look at inequality globally. We're seeing in countries like in Asia and in Mexico, where there once was a growing middle class, those people driven back into poverty. And we're going to see how that affects U.S. businesses here in the United States, as people who once could afford to buy U.S. products no longer are able to.
With us also on the line is Libero Della Piana, who is a senior research associate at the Applied Research Center, which is a policy and research institute focusing on issues of race and social change based in Oakland. Welcome to the program. How would you see race and gender playing on to this picture of social disparity and economic distinction between rich and poor?
Well, as you said, of the one-third of us who are in poverty, there's a disproportionate number of people of color, children, and women who are included in that. And in particular, I would say that one of the fundamental problems with economics and how it affects communities of color is really about the crisis of education and the links between racial disparity and education and what that means for what people of color will achieve in the economy when they're out of school.
Well, there was just a study, I believe, a couple of weeks back about the possibility of people going to university. I think the report said that pretty much the stupidest rich person had a better chance of getting an education at college than the smartest poor one, or something to that effect.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things we've also found is that the chances of a white high school dropout of getting a job are much higher than an African-American or a Latino who has a high school degree. So one of the myths that we learn about, you know, if you just get your high school education, if you just finish this, then you'll be able to get a good job, you'll be able to compete. It's really not true for people of color. The bar is lowered or raised.
I'd like to ask you both this question. In the U.S. culture, it's kind of a founding myth, the whole Horatio Alger sort of notion that people who are poor are so because they've simply failed to pull their socks up far enough. I don't know how far socks are supposed to come, but they haven't come up high enough. You haven't worked hard enough. It's your fault if you're poor. And to confront that myth, we need not just facts, but new rhetoric, I think. How are you managing, and are you managing, to convey to people the story that you and Sarah are both painting here, which is that poverty of a large and growing sector of the population isn't just sort of a pox on the poor's houses, but something that holds back the whole society's ability to grow and sustain some kind of stability? Libero, and then we'll come to Sarah on that.
Well, we are really promoting the idea that you can't deal with issues such as poverty or education that have a direct link to communities of color, have a disproportionate effect on communities of color, without specifically addressing race. And that's a difficult thing because, you know, in this country, race has been such a dividing line. But I think it does hit home in communities of color that if you just try to raise, float all boats, a lot of boats are leaky. And you raise the level for everyone, some people are still left behind.
Well, I'm being told here that apparently pulling up your socks is an Anglicism and that it's bootstraps that we should be talking about. It shows how much I know about the founding mythology of the United States. Sarah Anderson, we're going to come to you for a comment on that in just a moment. This is Laura Flanders sitting in for Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with you in just one moment. Minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Sarah Anderson, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, is with us in our studios in Washington. Sarah, we were just talking about spin on how poverty affects the majority in the U.S. I'd also like you to address the picture of wealth in this country. But first, tell us a little bit about how you try to convey to people in your work how the vast disparity between rich and poor affects us all.
Well, you mentioned this Horatio Alger perspective, and I think that is clearly untrue in today's economy. We're seeing productivity levels rising in the United States and in many countries around the world. We're seeing corporate profits rising tremendously. We're also seeing people working longer and longer hours, and yet the workers are not getting the fair share of those benefits. In the U.S., we had a recent slight uptick in the value of real wages, but they're still lower today than they were in 1989. And I think workers are understanding quite clearly why this is, and that's because in many of their experiences, they see the productivity rising, they see the corporations doing well, but when they ask for a raise, their boss often replies with something along the lines of, well, if you don't like what you're making, if you don't like this job, I'll just move this company to Mexico or some other low-wage country where people will work for one-tenth of what you're working here. And I think that therefore the globalization of the economy, the increased mobility of corporations, and their ability to pit workers against each other, trying always to get the lowest wages, has contributed to what we're seeing with wage levels.
What about that question of the mobility of capital? Although many corporations and corporate executives, as you say, use the threat of moving their industries abroad, there are some people, including Francis Fox Piven and others, who say that corporate mobility within the United States is actually far greater than any movement of capital outside or across national borders.
It is a tremendous reality. We've seen many companies moving from urban areas in the north where unionization rates tend to be higher to rural and other areas in the southern United States where there's a much stronger anti-union presence there. That's been going on for a long time. But what is fascinating is to see companies that have moved from, in many cases, from European countries to the north of the United States, to the south of the United States, to Mexico, and on down. It's just a constant race to the bottom in wages and working standards.
And one last comment from Libero della Piana on the question of wealth. In June, Forbes magazine released its annual list of the 200 wealthiest people who control a combined total of more than $1 trillion in wealth, an average of $5 billion apiece. How do we explain that, perceive that, even think of numbers like that in today's economy? What kind of wealth does that mean? What is it really?
Well, you know, I think that that's the kind of wealth that it adds up to many, many people's lives, the total, you know, economic power of whole communities, whole, you know, societies, and that, you know, that power is as, it's as powerful as many countries, and that right within this country we have a separate world that people of color live in, which is so distinct from that, and that it's almost a parody. And I think that that kind of wealth is so out of the reality of people of color. They don't even probably understand that it exists. And the sad thing is that those folks who have that wealth have an immense amount of power in the society and have the power to intervene to address some of these issues, but really they're there to benefit their own interests.
One last closing comment from you, Sarah Anderson.
Well, as you point out, it is hard to imagine what people can do with all of this money. One thing that I look at a lot in my work are the proxy statements, which are the corporate reports where they reveal how much the executives make. And what I find amusing sometimes is when I look at the kinds of perquisites that the corporate executives make. And so it'll be a company that's laid off several thousand workers but paid the CEO $4 or $5 million. And then what you look at when you look at what kind of perks they make, often it'll be something like expenditures for home security systems, you know, construction of security gates and guard posts. And you realize that these people are high, they might have a lot of money, but they're hiding behind tremendous security systems. And you see it even more extreme extent in countries like Mexico, where people with even middle class people now live in such fear of being kidnapped for their money. And that's a road we don't want to go down in this country, where we have such extreme divisions. And I think we all need to think about how we can turn this trend around.
Mm. That's Sarah Anderson, a senior research fellow at IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies, speaking to us from Washington. With us on the line from Oakland, California, is Libero Della Piana, who's a senior research associate at the Applied Research Center. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, a women's music group that is using its power, its resources, to bring attention to domestic violence. Stay tuned. Listening to La Di Da from a new CD called Blender, the latest release from the band The Murmurs, who have joined us here in our studio. The Murmurs are Heather Grody and Leisha Haley, and as they tour the country promoting their new CD, they're using part of the tour, at least, as an opportunity to raise awareness about an issue that hits very close to home for the duo, that of domestic violence. In 1993, Heather Grody's mother was killed by her husband. We're going to hear more about that in a moment. At each city on their tour, the Murmurs have invited a local domestic violence shelter to receive a portion of the concert's proceeds and also to be on hand at the concerts to meet with the audience and help raise awareness about the crime of domestic violence. Let's start with you, Heather. Has domestic violence been the motivating force for the Murmurs from the start?
From the very start of our career, 8 years ago, no. In fact, I don't think I was even aware of the term domestic violence. When Leisha and I started, I'd actually lived with the man that killed my mom in high school, but it was such a normal thing for me. I wasn't used to anything else. So, you know, no, I mean, I'm sure some of our music or some of the music that I wrote was, you know, subconsciously inspired by that, but not really from the get-go.
There's nothing on this CD that speaks directly to the issue.
No, there was something on our last CD, a song called Sleepless Commotion, that was the song that really defined my experience. It was really hard for me to write anything else after my mom died, you know, anything but, you know, tragic songs. And so finally, when I wrote Sleepless Commotion, which is on our last CD, I sort of felt like, okay, I've said it.
Time to keep going.
Yeah.
Tell us about Roar, Rock Out Against Rage. It's the part of your tour that's allowing audiences to meet with domestic violence groups. Who have you been working with so far? What kinds of groups? And what's been the outcome, Leisha Haley?
Well, we've been working with different organizations in each city, and we take the proceeds from our album sales and the ticket sales, and we give it to the charity. And it's been great. We've raised a lot of money for the different places, and a lot of them are, you know, transition houses where women can, you know, they have groups, therapy groups, and they have places they can put the women up with their families, because a lot of times women have nowhere else to go. And that's what's so great about it, because, you know, if Heather's mom had maybe known about one of these places at the time. Oh, this here's a statistic that we learned, that the chances of a woman getting murdered after she leaves the house actually raise. And that was really interesting, because a lot of times, you know, people tell the women, just get out, run, go somewhere else. You just get out of the situation. But it actually puts them in a more vulnerable and dangerous situation to run away, because the men follow them. They don't have safe places to go. So that's a lot of times why women end up staying, because I think instinctually they know.
Mm. Well, so what about that, Heather? There are lots of stereotypes about domestic violence and people who are beaten in the home and people who do the beating. Where do you think the stereotypes are true? Where do they not ring true for you?
Well, first I just want to touch on what Leisha was saying. Is like, my mom, for example, she never got away from Jim. Was her husband. And she couldn't get a moment free. I mean, if I was talking to my mom on the phone, Jim was sitting right next to her, listening, you know, and sort of my mom would be, the more I would talk to my mom, the more things sort of escalated, you know, and to a negative point, the more my mom would be vague with me on the phone. Mm. And my mom and I were really, really close, extremely close, but, you know, here's a very common thing I think that happens, is I knew that Jim was crazy from my experience living with him. He was abusive mentally, emotionally, and physically to the house, never to my mom in front of us. I mean, he was really smart that way. And when I was talking to my mom, I had asked her, I was like, is he hitting you? Is anything going on? You know, because I knew that they were drinking again, and that's a stereotypical thing about, you know, alcohol and drugs. And so, you know, just long sleeve shirts my mom would wear, and I had no clue. But as soon as I got a phone call from my brother, who was living in New Hampshire at the time, which is where they lived, they had moved to, my brother called me and said, where's mom? I knew something terrible had happened, and I knew that he was capable of it, but I never in a million years actually thought that something that drastic would happen, even though I did know.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird.
That's Heather Grody, who with Leisha Haley is The Murmurs, a band who have a new CD out called Blender. A portion of their tour proceeds are going to domestic violence groups around the country. Let's move from the issue of domestic violence to the music on the CD and your music in past records. We hear a lot about young women's bands and how it's all part of some new trend. And one of the stereotypes, while we're talking about stereotypes, that's often sort of laid at the feet of new up-and-coming women singers is that they're self-absorbed. You know, this kind of, isn't life terrible? I've fought back, but it's hard to fight back as a girl. It's wild, isn't it, that the minute that a woman speaks out, suddenly women are self-absorbed?
Mm-hmm.
Tell your own story and you're self-obsessed. Listen to everyone else's and you're just a regular girl. What sort of tradition do you see yourself in? Who are your role models? Who are you inspired by? Who do you think your music speaks to? Start with you, Leisha.
Well, our music has changed so much since 8 years ago when we first started. We used to be an acoustic duo, and we'd go down in the New York City subways, and we'd play there and, you know, trying to get a buck, you know, we were poor. And,
a buck for a cigarette.
Yeah, for a cigarette. And at this point now, we're a full electric five-piece band with drum loops and keyboards and, you know, loud guitars with distortion. And it's just been interesting because we don't really know who we are this whole time. We've just been organically growing musically and trying to find our sound, I guess, the whole way. But you just sort of do it on record, you know?
And I also think it's really interesting that, you know, when Leisha and I first started being an acoustic duo, we constantly got compared to the Indigo Girls, who I think are absolutely, I love them. But, you know, at the same time, the only thing we had in common is that we both played guitars and our voices sounded nothing like them.
Well, you're girls, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, people basically said, you know, there's not a market really out there for your music. And so we had a really hard time.
We would get compared to, you know, the 60s. Oh, you're just a 60s throwback because you're playing acoustic guitars. And we were talking about this the other day, how funny it is, because now that whole sound, the whole acoustic, you know, female singer thing is so popular. And it wasn't when we were doing it. And now we've flipped and gone pop and electric, and
everybody's,
you know,
doing the acoustic.
Yeah, so we're kind of missing the boat every time, but hopefully, you know, but something will happen.
At times, I mean, it's not that I don't feel resentful, but I feel frustrated with people making such a negative deal about women coming out and, like, the whole Lilith thing. I think it's an amazing event. I mean, you know, nobody started dogging on
Lilith,
know,
the tour, the women's music tour.
Yeah, Lilith Fair. But nobody started dogging on, what was that big tour? The first, Lollapalooza. Nobody was like, oh, that's all, you know, C-rock bands, and you know what I mean? And that was a cover-up for a bad word. but, you know, when they're all men up there, I mean, nobody says, oh, they're the next...
or on the radio, for that matter.
Go-go's all the time.
You're not suggesting that here in 1998 there's still sexism in the music industry, are you?
Oh, gosh, no.
No.
Tell us a little bit about promotion. What kinds of obstacles are in your way, or what kinds of challenges you still find when it comes to promoting your music, given everything that you've just said about the tendency of reporters really not to listen to what you're saying, but to put you in a category before they've even heard what your music sounds like?
Well, this is actually interesting. Something I think we're having a struggle with is that, you know, until, of course, you're all over the radio, and you go to a town and the radio sponsors your show and you can have all age shows. Until that point, you end up playing clubs that are 21 and over. And I feel like for a pop act, there's really no way to grassroots market yourself to kids, because you can't play a theater where you can have kids, where there's no alcohol, unless you're huge. Mm-hmm. So really, it sort of goes back to what Tiffany did in the 80s. And you know, you could either play malls or amusement parks or things like that. That's the only choice you have for all ages, or you can play 21 and over clubs. So we're because a lot of times we play these clubs and there's kids outside that want to come in, and those are the kids I really feel like our music is reaching, and it's frustrating.
Last word to you, Heather Grody, on this question of how do you move forward?
We move forward by believing in ourselves, and we do believe in grassroots. Our live show is the most important thing to us, and I think it's important for people to see us, because that's what it's about playing live. We've been working very hard, and we're going to continue to work hard. So I just hope that everyone buys this record. We're really proud of it. I think we've finally reached a place where, okay, we finally might know who we are or who we're becoming.
Let's hope more people get to find out for themselves who the Murmurs are. That's Heather Grody and Leisha Haley. The new CD is called Blender. Here's another cut about nothing.
Change your mind about nothing. About nothing. You gave up everything for me. I gave up.
Well, The Murmurs may have been about nothing, that last cut, but this show certainly hasn't been. Democracy Now, from international violence to domestic violence, with a little bit of the violence of poverty in between. You have been listening to Pacifica Radio. Who else? If you want to reach Democracy Now, we have a comment line at 212-209-2999. And if you want to hear this program on the web, you can check us out at www.pacifica.org. www.pacifica.org, and that website will show you how to reach Democracy Now. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now program, you can call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Koo and Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Many thanks today to Kenneth Mason, who engineered from Washington. Michelle Garcia is our web spinner. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!